Hey everyone, welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber, and it is Terrificon week here on Comic Book Central. I kicked things off a few days ago with part one of my five-part epic adventure at the super cool comic book sci-fi pop culture convention that is Terrificon. The show takes place in Uncasville, Connecticut. It is the brainchild of my IndieCast buddy, Mitch Halleck. You can find out everything you need to know about Terrificon at the website. Of course, it's terrificon.com. Or you can check out the show notes for this episode, for the five parts. I'm going to put it in the show notes at my website for each episode, comicbookcentral.net. I'll put the link to the Terrificon website in there. I will say this, plans are well underway for 2017, so be sure to check out that website. Be sure to check out Terrificon on Facebook for all the upcoming announcements. And on social media, they're recapping this year's show as well. So you're seeing pictures, reviews, news, all kinds of crazy cool stuff, videos, everything's out there. So if you haven't been there, if you want to see what it's like, if you want to hear what it's all about, check out Terrificon on Facebook, check out the website, and man, just stay tuned to Comic Book Central. I'm bringing a bunch of it to you. You are on the bonus plan this week, my friends. I hope you caught part one. It is available at the usual places, the website comicbookcentral.net, where you can stream or download all of the episodes. Subscribe in iTunes or Blueberry. You get all the episodes that are out there. You get all the upcoming episodes, so that's the easiest way. You can listen on Stitcher or social media, facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork, Twitter at comicbookctrl. All episodes are posted on social media. Help me out by sharing the lair. Share the lair. Click share on Facebook. Retweet it on Twitter. Thanks to everyone out there who's been doing just that. Now, if you caught part one, you heard from a bunch of people. Tony Todd, Rene Aubergenois, Sean Gunn, Peter David, AMC's Comic Book Men. You also heard the Q&A I moderated with Gotham's Cameron B. Condova, where she provided a nice preview for season three of Gotham. That was pretty cool. So if you haven't heard that episode yet, by all means, go check it out after today's show. Now, Q&As were a huge part of Terrificon this year. There were a bunch of them. I moderated five of them, and I'm bringing them all to you this week. Today, I am featuring my Terrificon Q&A with artist and animator Rick Hoberg. Rick's work was a big part of my childhood. I'm sure many of you out there feel the same way. He worked on a ton of our favorite cartoons in the 70s and 80s. Check this out. Super Friends, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, The Incredible Hulk, G.I. Joe, in the 90s, X-Men, more recently, Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes, Ultimate Spider-Man, Hulk and the Agents of Smash, on and on. The list goes on. Comic books? Doesn't get much more iconic than Spider-Man, Batman, Green Arrow, Green Lantern, just to name a few. Rick worked on all of them. He even spent time in that galaxy far, far away. That's right. Marvel's Star Wars series. If you're familiar with those oversized Marvel Treasury editions, you've definitely then enjoyed Rick's art on those iconic covers. I know I have. They're some of my favorite books. 40 years later, Rick is still crafting beautiful artwork in the world of Star Wars. We talk about that in the Q&A, so let's just get right to it, true believers. Here is my Terrificon Q&A with Rick Hoberg.
About animation, we'll talk a little bit about everything. We're going to talk about Spider-Man, we're going to talk about Hulk, we'll talk about Star Wars. Sounds great. Some Star Wars fans in here. And we'll turn it over to you. So think about some questions that you want to have. If you like some of the shows from the past that we're talking about, some things that went on, you're interested in how these things sort of come together, we're going to be talking about that. Let's go back, let's go all the way back. First of all, what kind of a kid were you? Were you interested in comics as a kid? Were you interested in comic books coming to life, cartoons?
Absolutely. It literally was obsessive from the time I was 5 or 6 years old. My dad bought me my first Del Tarzan comic book. And I fell in love with that stuff. And animation I loved too. I watched cartoons in the afternoons and on Saturday mornings as a kid. But the one that really clicked with me was when Johnny Quest came on in about 1960. And I just fell in love with it because it was basically a comic book brought to life, and it had a lot of sci-fi stuff, it had a lot of Terry and the Pirates in it, and it was just in years later, my first job in animation was given to me by Doug Wildey, who created Johnny Quest, and so it was just fortuitous for me, because the minute I heard who was calling and he asked me if I'd like to work on a show with him, I said, absolutely, you know, so it was a great run that way. And I basically read a lot of comics. I fell in love with Marvel Comics just shortly after they started up with and changed their name to Marvel Comics from Atlas, because as a kid I grew up reading Archie and mostly DC Comics, a lot of Batman, Superman, those titles. And then my folks would travel a lot to go fishing on fishing trips, so to keep me quiet, they bought me comic books. And at one point on one of these trips, we stopped at a store in Bishop, California. I remember this bookstore like it was yesterday. And they were all out of everything I'd read other than these Marvel comics. So I picked up Spider-Man number 3, the first issue of the Avengers. I have all of these.
Yes.
I kept
that was the horror story. Everybody says
no, I never got rid of anything. No, I never got rid of anything. And a couple of Strange Tales with the Human Torch. And I believe one of them was that issue where they brought back Captain America for the first time.
Yeah.
And immediately I was just hooked. On the way back through, headed home, I told my dad, we got to stop one more time. I got to get every other thing that's on the racks there.
What did dad say? See,
oh, he was glad to keep me quiet. Yeah, so that was fine.
It was the iPad of his day.
Just
throw a kid an iPad today, but throw a kid a comic book.
Yeah, the comics are so tactile. They're like, I don't really enjoy digital comics much because I like the comic.
They don't have the old comic smell.
They don't smell like comics. Yeah. They don't feel like them. They're not a tangible thing. So it's like books. I listen to audiobooks, and I own a Kindle, but I prefer reading a book personally.
Yeah, it's nice if you got to take a bunch with you, but there's nothing like that feel.
Right.
Now, I mean, I could probably speak for everybody in here. We've all read comic books when we were kids. We all watched cartoons. How do you translate that into working in animation? And you started off in comic strips and comic books. I mean, how did you sort of break into the business first? And what were some of those early projects you worked on?
I was a big fan, like most of you are, and these were the early days of the kind of organized fandom. There were things back in the 1930s and 40s, but the 1960s were when fanzines began to proliferate. I worked on a fanzine with a guy out of Morristown here. I never actually met him, a guy named Gino Membrino, and Gino and I put together, and Don Parmalee was the other guy, and he did some work of note, I believe, in comics, and we put together a fanzine. And then I later became the president of a comic book club in Orange County, California, where I grew up. And because of this, I met Russ Manning, who was the creator of Magnus Robot Fighter, and he was well known for drawing Tarzan. He not only drew Tarzan after Jesse Marsh left the comic books for Dell, he took over the comic strip in the 1960s. And probably for my money, did the definitive Tarzan.
That's what I want to touch on, because I know sometimes you mention about your role in that. What was your role in working on that, and how amazing was that?
Well, that's what I'm getting to.
That was one of your first loves, was the Tarzan comic.
Exactly, I love Tarzan.
Yeah.
And I basically met Russ, and then we had art shows, and I was beginning to show my art at these art shows. Within the club, we had the art shows, and Russ at one point had seen my work, and he called me about 1975, and he said, "Yeah, listen, I need some guys to draw stuff for overseas publication, and you know, are you interested?" He said, "You're going to have to the thing I need is somebody who can ape my style, who can basically do a Russ Manning." So I figured, what the heck, I can trace Russ Manning, and that's how I actually got started, was doing that sort of thing, and then. That job lasted a very short time, maybe a year, and right after that, I got a gig working with Roy Thomas on some Marvel comics, because he was starting a group. Having left Marvel in New York, he was still an editor, but he had his own group of guys, and I was among the first that started working with him. And I did some what-ifs, I did some Conan and Cole fill-in work, basically, just illustrations and nothing of major note. And then I did some what-ifs for him, which did real well, and Star Wars came along. And he basically couldn't get anybody interested in it who was already getting work, because everybody thought this was a shot in the pan, basically. It wasn't going to go anywhere. And I knew what it was, because I was a movie fan. I'd been reading about Lucas's work in the LA Times for years. and I knew what Star Wars was. I didn't know what it was going to be, but the minute he asked me, would I do some stuff for this, I said, absolutely, give me the job, and those covers made my career.
Well, I think those are even stories, too, that Marvel almost had to be convinced to do Star Wars in the first place. I mean, that wasn't it wasn't the lock and load situation. No. I mean, it was... I mean, we look back at it now and go, wow, how can you not? But
well, originally it looked at as like one of those movie adaptations, because back in those days, Marvel was adapting old movies and new. They did Logan's Run.
The Jaws.
They actually did Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, too. They did an issue of that. And these things sold terribly. But Marvel was in a terrible strait. Most people don't know that the late 70s were a terrible time for comics. Marvel was almost ready to go out of business. They weren't getting any sales. Even DC was in bad straits, but not as bad as Marvel. And Star Wars came along and saved Marvel. It sold so well that they reprinted these comics over and over again. They sold millions of copies, which was unheard of at that point. And it literally got people reading comics for Marvel again, so it was a huge windfall for everybody. Originally, they were just going to do it as a one-off and call it a day.
Well, that was the way for all of us. Well, back in the day, that was the way for us to relive the movie. We didn't have VHS. We didn't have all this. You either had to go see the movie. If it wasn't in the theaters, you had to wait for the reissue to come back. So we got those comics and just relived them over and over. And like you said, they just kept repackaging them. Challenges of going from a comic strip to comic books. What are the... I mean, obviously, the difference in the storytelling is you've got four panels, but...
it's a really difficult medium. I did Star Wars,
the comic
strip after Russ passed away. They handed it to me because I was the assistant. And I did it with Dave Stevens for about 2 months, and it's incredibly grueling. It's deceptively hard to do. It looks simple. Most people do a comic strip so that it's very much like a soap opera. So it's people talking to each other, and soap operas are very easy to do. For comic strips, because you're just doing headshots of people talking. But Star Wars is an adventure story, so you've got to have action and other stuff. Well, try telling a full-blown story in three panels a day, where at least one panel every day has to be a recap of something that you've seen before. It's just brutal. I disliked it intensely. I've only worked on that one, and I did a little bit of work on another strip that's eluding me at the moment, but I really wouldn't do it again.
Well, it's easy if you had peanuts or something like that, if you're Charles Schulz and you're just telling a joke.
Exactly.
That day. But if you're telling a sequential
story... But still, that
story,
takes brilliant comedy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You're better off doing the simple drawing. Yeah, the simple drawings. I mean, the quintessential comic strip for me is Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah.
I just think it's the best thing ever done in comic strips.
Yeah.
But... you look back on the ones that I loved as a kid, Prince Valiant, Tarzan,
Mandrake the Magician.
Yeah, Mandrake, Terry the Pirates, all of those. They had like full Sunday pages to tell a story, and that was hugely helpful, but still tough work to do.
Yeah, I would imagine too. Now, how do you segue that into animation? Because we're sort of put us in that in historical perspective too, because this is when late 70s, they were kind of farming out all the characters
right.
in different animation studios, and then like, well, let's do our own. Why farm everything out? So kind of put us in that era.
They actually weren't the same entity. It was Marvel was the name on it, but it was Stan Lee who wanted to go out there and get into the movie business and into show business of anything he could get into. He just wanted to get into it. And he was part owner of Marvel, because his uncle, Martin Goodman, created a Timely Comics back in the 1940s. He was the initial publisher. Stan got on as, I think he was a 15-year-old, as a writer, and then became an editor very quickly. And Goodman's son, Chip, I believe his name was, became the publisher, and he's the one who ferried it through the 1950s as Atlas, and then it became Marvel Comics. And Stan always had a piece of the action. Very smart businessman. I admire him highly for that. And he had ended up wanting to be in show business, but these entities were always at odds with each other. They actually had to license out from Marvel Comics to Marvel Productions, so they didn't actually own the project. But that was one of Marvel's big problems in the movie and television business, is they optioned their projects to too many people who couldn't get these things off the ground but still had the option, so they couldn't take them anywhere else. That's why it took years to get Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four onto the big screen. And it's also, we're very fortunate that when Marvel Studios decided to start up, that Marvel was going to become a studio unto itself, they didn't have access to those characters. So we got the Avengers. And that, to me, is the best of all the worlds. I think the Avengers are the best.
It worked out.
You have those individual characters. Yeah. Well, to me, those guys were the greatest. When I read the comics initially, the book that just stunned me was the Avengers, because I got Thor, I got Captain America, I got the Hulk, and Giant Man, Ant-Man.
Well, that was the thing, they kind of said, what characters do we have left? And then somebody went, oh, it's the Avengers. That was the characters that
I think they're perfect. In fact, the best thing they could have done is do Iron Man, because Iron Man is very James Bondian when you get him into a film. But on top of that, to cast the perfect guy, Robert Downey Jr. He is Tony Stark. Even his life reflects who Tony Stark in the comics was. So it's just the perfect piece of casting.
Yeah, and even that almost didn't happen. He even had the audition board. It was amazing.
Let me finish about how this worked. The transitioning, the stuff, the animation you wanted to know about, that is that's the difference between comic storytelling and animation storytelling, when you're doing these kind of things, is the fact that one thing is done in design. That is, comics are based on moving the eye across a page in some simple form, an S, a Z, any simple form, a 2, that makes the eye look like this and follow the story, where animation is all about movement and timing. That's why when you take a character, Spider-Man's a great example. Like Spider-Man, in the comics, he's just talking all the time. I mean, the panels are filled with things he's saying to bad guys while he's leaping across something, saying things that couldn't even be said in the time that's given there. So it's a difficult thing to translate into film, but what I'm getting at is there's timing and movement involved, as opposed to what your imagination is piecing together between the panels when you're reading comics. So it was a matter of translating that. And it took years to get it right, to be honest with you. I actually don't think the Spider-Man was done well until Spider-Man the Animated Series came out.
1994.
I think that was the first really great one. And I worked on all of these, so I feel I have a critical eye to it. But we were pretty proud of Spider-Man and his amazing friends.
Yeah, let's talk about some of these things. I mean, we're looking at 1978. Was it Jane and the Jungle?
The first show I worked on was Godzilla, the Hanna-Barbera version. That's the first job I got. Okay. Doug Wiley producing and directing it. And Jana was brought on because they wanted to do an NBC liked it so much. They wanted to do an hour, and they called it the Godzilla Power Hour. Yeah. And they put in Jana in the Jungle. Who the heck thinks that a Jungle Girl and Godzilla work together? I don't know. But they were two separate things, Jana in the Jungle being a Sheena, Queen of the Jungle type of character, basically, and pretty silly.
Yeah. But I mean, a good start too. And then one of my personal favorites, probably many out here too, the Super Friends. And I know your work was probably minimal on some of them, but I think you were on like 8 episodes. What was your role coming into the Super Friends? And then talk a little bit about the challenges of bringing these comic book characters, these iconic characters, Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, all of them, into sort of the limited animation world of the late 70s.
The way it's done best with that kind of animation is the way they did it in Johnny Quest. It's basically still pictures with a minimum of movement, and you're looking at it the way you read a comic book. And it works really well. It's basically what you all would know as an animatic. We use them these days to, when I do a storyboard, I quite often work in a program called Storyboard Pro these days, and that allows me to time it out so that when it's sent to the director, it's actually a small movie that's just a series of pictures. But it looks semi-animated because I'm animating movements throughout it, doing extremes. And an extreme in animation is something where, let's say I'm sitting at the table like this and I go like this, a gesture. Well, the two extremes are this and this, and the animator fills in what goes between, basically. So that's the way this kind of limited animation works best. When we were doing shows like Super Friends and Spider-Man, they wanted to push it further, so you got some really terrible animation, and they were paying so little for it and started going overseas to have it done that you have some of those wonderful things that happen One of my favorites is when a character is looking like this way and talking, and then his head turns to look this way, but his mouth stays over here talking. I probably saw that 50 or 60 times in Super Friends.
Didn't we even get, I mean, sometimes there's like strange things in the logos, or maybe the coloring isn't even right, and we kind of, I guess as kids, you know, if I'm 6, 7 years old watching that, I don't care.
You don't pay attention?
No, Super Friends is live action. I haven't heard it. But yeah, now you can go back and look at it and kind of pick it apart. So.
Sometimes they just didn't have the money or the time to do retakes. They just said, nope, we're going to have to live with that. Or they cut it out and do something else. But
the deadlines were there.
Yeah, the animation was so limited and it was so cheap. They were paying as little as they could for it.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the competition became more... vibrant that you had to start upping the ante, and that happened going into the late 80s and especially in the 90s. I think the show that really upped the ante for all this was Batman the Animated Series.
That was a game changer. Yeah.
Even though, you know, I was working, I had helped put together and was working on X-Men the Animated Series, and our wonderful thing was, even though it wasn't nearly as good looking a show, we kicked their butts every week in the ratings. So
that's for,
it was like, you know, as much as I love watching Batman, it's nice to be on top.
Yeah, the X-Men was huge too. So, well, let's talk. I mean, we've got this whole list of one. I want to throw out to the audience if you have any questions too. We got one right here already.
I got a question because it's a two-part question.
How about, we've got time.
How long did it take to make just one episode, because I know they have to make them like 6 or 7 or whatever months in advance. And then my favorite when I was a kid growing up was Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. Now, it's available on DVD in Great Britain, but it isn't in the United States, and I can't understand how a show that popular, at least from my...
Yeah, Rick Hubbard, why can't we get it?
Why can't I get it? Why can't I get it?
Hey, I'm just the storyboard artist, you know? No, I know what you're talking about, and to be honest with you, I think this has to do with who's got distribution rights and so forth, but now that Disney's in control of all this, I think they'll be marketing all of it, and sooner or later, that will be available. I don't understand it either, because I figured it was buried for years, and then it showed up on... Disney XD started showing it too. That's where they started showing the Marvel stuff, and they were showing X-Men the Animated Series and a few others, and those became so popular that none of us knew that this was leading to the deal that would make Marvel a part of Disney, basically. Which I actually feel was a great deal. I think that worked out well for me.
And so your other question too, just like how long does it take an episode of Spider-Man's Amazing Friends?
That probably, you're probably in the ballpark with 7 to 8 months from beginning to end.
One episode,
but you got to remember there's other things, there's other episodes being put together at the same time. They have a production schedule, they need to stay with it. It's longer now, and they do much more quality work now. Like, I work on Transformers Robots in Disguise right now, and that's a beautifully done show. It's just really lovely to look at.
So even with the computer assist, it's taking longer than just straight up animation than we do?
Are you of the opinion computers have simplified things?
Well, I don't know. Fair enough. Well, it's the other argument too. It's like these movies cost like $250 million, and you're like, I thought it should cost less by now. But yeah, I would think, you know, they would shorten the time, but you're saying it's actually longer now for animation.
Well, I think you just have to build it into the production. There's a discussion going on Facebook and in the media, like on Geek Tyrant and these things about Sausage Party, that R-rated animated film that just came out, and how they basically hired a bunch of kids and they drove them like slaves to get this thing out and stuff. And that's what happens in this media when you try to push this stuff through, because it's not easy to do, and it does take a long time. I worked for a number of years recently on Halo, and I got to sit in the studio for a long time with a guy's animating this stuff. And it just takes a tremendous amount of time to do just one little sequence. Have any of you seen that piece from Halo 5, the opening shot where they jump out of the ship and they go down under the snow and they're battling all those guys? I know the guy, I watched the guy work on that sequence. It took him over a year to do that 1 3-minute sequence. And he was working on it every day. And all of that's rigged. So it's not like he's actually drawing the characters or anything. A rigged figure in CGI animation is basically a built object that's built in the computer. And then they rig it. They put joints in it and stuff like that so it'll move at the right places. And the animator just has to pose it and animate it out. But it just takes forever. Animation's a very meticulous process. And something like that is just stunning to look at. So the early stuff was not as good, and that's why it was taking less time to do, basically.
Question right over here, Superman.
What was your favorite episode to work with, or favorite strip? What would you
done? Now, are you talking of all everything I've done, or of animation, or what?
Everything.
I have a lot of favorite things I worked on. Star Wars is always near and dear, because I still continue to work for those people. I do a lot of the line drawings you see on t-shirts and stuff like that. A lot of that stuff's my stuff. Lucas, they've got me working on episode 8 right now. So I love the fact there's new Star Wars films, because I get to draw Star Wars at least a month every year now.
We talked about that, because there's Star Wars 1977-78, whatever would have come out, the comic book. Issue number 5 is a t-shirt.
I've heard that. I haven't seen it, but I've heard
it. I own it. Yeah. Many of you probably own it too. It's on a t-shirt. The Millennium Falcon. Red t-shirt.
That's one of the ones I see all the time. I met a young woman on an airplane. We started talking about what we were doing, and she was interested in what I did. We had gotten off the flight. I had been coming from a comic book convention, and she says, "What is this stuff you do exactly? What does it look like?" And I looked over, and there was a guy wearing one of my Death Star t-shirts. I said, "It looks like that. That's one of them right there. You're walking right past this." And the two I see the most are that Death Star t-shirt and the Millennium Falcon t-shirt.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Yours?
Yeah, that's mine. Oh, that's the red one. Yeah. And there's one out there that's an iron-on. Remember the old iron-ons, plastic feeling things? There's an iron-on one with a Millennium Falcon, some TIE fighters on and stuff. That one is a Millennium Falcon that when I did it, I hid my wife's name in the little machinery on one of the prongs of the Millennium Falcon. And this was done at Lucasfilm years ago. I finally told them about it. They weren't happy.
Why did you tell them? They eradicated it
because I don't want to fool this guy. I've worked with him for 30 years. And they had published it a number of times. Well, Disney just recently got hold of all this stuff, and they obviously weren't paying attention, because there it is out on the market again.
Lesson learned. Don't tell them anything. Well, it's a good segue, too, then. How do you go from the Star Wars comic to getting into these licensed things for Lucasfilm? Because that's a big deal.
Oh, yeah. Believe me, I feel very fortunate.
You're doing it right now.
And everybody in the business has been trying to get this job. Everybody for years. The guy I worked with just years ago said to me just the other day when we were working on new stuff, he said, "So what's this con you're going to?" I told him some of the guests. He goes, "Oh, Neil Adams." Yeah, and I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, he tried to get this job for his continuity studios years ago, but no, we're happy with what you do." And I went, "Oh, that's awesome." Yeah, no.
Stop telling him you're hiding stuff in the drawer.
Exactly. When I did tell him about that, they then went through a bunch of the stuff I did for The Phantom Menace, and of course they thought the big hit in The Phantom Menace was going to be Jar Jar Binks, right? And they had me do, like, I don't know, 20 or 30 drawings of this character. Well, at one point they called me in after the fiasco with the Millennium Falcon, and they said, "Did you write 'I love you' in the modeling of Jar Jar Binks' arm?" I said, "No, it wasn't intentional, but I got to tell you, it does look like 'I love you.'" You know?
Who was the illustrator? The always put Nina, his daughter's name.
Alberto. I know who you're talking about. He's one of the great caricaturists of all time.
I'll remember when the panel's over. But the other question too was your favorite.
What I call the old guy sympathy.
I know.
Right
I got it.
Oh,
no,
I forget. Thank God.
I know. And I'm already there, so that's the problem with that. But one of your favorite episodes was one of the questions too. So do you have a favorite episode? Spider-Man's Amazing Friends or
no? My favorite cartoon show I've ever worked on was one I worked on about 8 or 10 years ago. Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes. It was the best Marvel cartoon ever done. Just really faithful, and we enjoyed doing every minute of that. The writers knew everything about this stuff. They knew how to condense it where they had to tell the stories. They gave us opportunities to do things that added to the iconography but stayed faithful. I even got to do the sequence with Captain America's origin, and I got to do a thing where Bucky dies. Cap had to let go of the rocket. He basically was knocked off the rocket as it flies away. And I got, before it exploded, I got to have Bucky salute him. And I'd always wanted to see that in the comics. I thought that would be appropriate for the character, basically. And then, in the second season, we brought him back as the Winter Soldier. You know, so it went from the early days to the new stuff, and it worked great.
Marvel done some great stuff in the animated series too. So yeah, good question. Right over here.
How would you have a new person get into the industry? Any recommendations for somebody starting out?
Yes, these days there's so many good people in the industry, both writers and artists. Schooling is imperative. If you're going to be an artist, go get as much education as you can before you take off to do it. Learn all the technical stuff. Learn perspective. Learn proportion of figures and how figures work. Learn acting as much as you can. Just all the technical is what makes you an actual artist. Once you apply all the technical stuff, your own personal artistry just comes out in that. It's not about mimicking other people, although it's okay to ape people that you like. You know, I was a big Gil Kane, Russ Manning fan. A lot of my work reflected that for years, and then I grew out of that. I became my own man, basically. But all of my early work has huge amounts of that stuff in it. And I actually learned that people, you know, learn from that. But I think education is primary these days. There's just too much competition. And another thing is, I would always say, find a way to get into a couple of different avenues. What's kept me alive in the business is being in animation and being in comics. Both of them, once I was done doing comics, literally, the day The Strangers ended for me, it was the last full strip I did for Ultraverse. They called, said, whatever you're working on, we'll pay you for it, but just stop working because, you know, it's done. Marvel's shutting it down. And once that happened, my wife said to me, well, what are we going to do for you know, you're not going to be able to make a living now for a bit. I said, let's give it a day and see what happens. And the next day, I got a call from one of my best buddies in animation. He said, you want to get back in the animation business? And it was just a quick transference over. So having a lot of doors open to you is big. Advertising's fine, too. It's a terrible way to make a living. But listen, anytime you get to draw for a living, it's a blessing.
Just keep doing it, right?
Yes, just keep
doing
whatever's
there.
Exactly.
We hear that in acting and with a lot of different things.
Just and do a lot of self-promotion, too. You know, Facebook, websites, whatever is popular time. Ever. I know Twitter and Instagram are great these days. I don't do Instagram enough, but that's where all the guys are promoting themselves.
It's RickHoberg.com, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a new website that's out there, too.
No, it's been around for years. It was a crappy website until recently. Now it's a
new
great
redesign.
Website.
Redesigned website. Very good question. Next, we have another question. I've got one about Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. That is one of my all-time favorite cartoons. Animated? Do you prefer cartoons or animated series?
Does it matter at this point? Cartoons is what I grew up calling them. So I'm
okay. I think the older I get, the more I'm reverting back to cartoons. Yeah. I think I like cartoons better. So, Firestar. Always some issues with her design.
That was NBC's doing.
And we'll keep it family-friendly. But that. Yeah, what were some of the challenges you faced over the seasons with Firestar's design?
Well, now we're talking about a period where we were just coming out of a period during the late 60s where they did all of these pretty violent and ridiculous cartoons that were fun to watch. Herculoids, Mighty Samson, a lot of those at Hanna-Barbera, they were really great cartoons, terrific, but they're nonsense. They really have nothing going on but a bunch of fighting. And there was a reverberation. There was a backlash of especially mothers who felt that these were too violent for children. Well, this was a huge drawback then. All of a sudden, there wasn't going to be any guns in any shows. There wasn't going to be any violence of any sort. And it took us 10 years to get back to where we could actually do action-adventure. And what you're talking about reflected those times. And then when NBC bought Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, and I designed Firestar from an initial drawing by John Romita. He basically did a pretty girl, which was Mary Jane Watson. That's what it was. and he made her flying with basically just, I think it was just a bodysuit. I don't recall too much detail being on it. Well, I went through and designed the character for animation, used his basic look for her. I changed the hair into a fire design, basically, and then added the wrist items and so forth to give it a little more character. And she was voluptuous, and, you know, it was a bodysuit, so I tried to give as much information as I could and still make it friendly. Well, every season, NBC said, at the beginning of a season, we went three seasons, said, no, you know, we've got to make her breasts a little smaller, and, you know, you can really see too much of her butt. We're going to have to make that, you know, make so there's not a big, you know, cracking their butt.
Oh, so what a difference so a line, by the time, line drawing.
And by the time season three comes along, literally, it's just a bump. You know, there isn't any line showing. There's any curvature at the gluteus maximus whatsoever. And her breasts are much smaller. But it was the times we were living in. And the thing that changed that is a show that I worked on. We were given, Hasbro came to Marvel after we finished Hulk. And that was basically it for Marvel. And they offered us a 5-episode miniseries of G.I. Joe. We could do whatever we wanted.
The gloves were off.
The gloves were off. We had guns to play with. We had fighting to play with. And we went a little crazy, but it was a gigantic hit. This thing was, after it was done, and it was nicely done, was given what did they call it at the time? It was multiple markets. It wasn't a,
syndication.
It was in syndication. It wasn't a network show. And it was shown, it was the only stipulation was it had to be shown 5 days in a row wherever it was shown.
Oh, okay, so you didn't have the network parameters on
exactly,
you as much.
Exactly. Okay. So it was shown sometimes in afternoon, sometimes early mornings, wherever you lived, it was a different time zone. But it was a massive hit. The only show that did bigger ratings at the time was Roots. It was it shocked us because we just went, a cartoon did that kind of ratings? And especially to beat Roots, it was a huge event in television at the time. And we ended up then getting the series going on and doing Transformers and stuff. And this opened the doors to where by the early 90s you had X-Men, you had Batman. It led to those wonderful Superman and Justice League cartoons and just all sorts of great stuff. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the second version of that, was something I got involved in, and that was just a joy.
You even had Rambo and RoboCop, I think, leading
up to it. Those were network shows.
Yeah.
Those were network shows. There was no guns in those, if you go back and look at them.
So they were just being syndicated, yeah. Yep. So you worked out all your frustrations in the G.I. Joe cartoon.
Well, you know, Rambo...
you couldn't do.
I worked on Rambo because I got a good offer over Ruby Spears, so I went over there to work.
So and I can't believe they made that animated series. That's just...
What, Rambo?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. T was just...
Toys,
was even worse, and the worst one they did was... Turbo Teen. I don't know if any of you remember that show. It's about a kid who turned into a Corvette Stingray. No Freudian things going on there, you know? And it was like, really? Who thought of this, you know? So those were a lot of terrible cartoons. But that was a point when, you know, you were making a living as well, because it really was a transitional point between all the great stuff that was to come, like in the funny animal stuff. You had Animaniacs and things like that, and Ren and Stimpy that were ahead and stuff, and it was a great opening for
us. Yeah, we'll be talking about that here in the next few minutes, too, with Bob Camp, too. One of my favorite characters is Captain Carrot. You worked on Captain Carrot a little bit. In the comic. Will we ever see a Captain Carrot animated film? Like, that to me seems like a no-brainer with all the cast of characters.
I think what you've got going on with characters like Captain Carrot is DC and Marvel are at a point where they don't want to have to pay royalties to anybody. And Roy Thomas and Scott Shaw and who's the guy who actually created it? It was Sam De La Rosa. It was Sam Granger, an artist who worked at Charlton and at Marvel and DC. He inked a couple of my pieces. He actually came up with this idea, and then Roy and didn't do it. He ended up with Roy and Scott doing it, but they don't want to pay any royalties for anybody for this, and these guys own the piece of the action, so I think that's why it's doubtful you'll actually ever see that.
Well, it would just seem like the toy line would just fall.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's just...
And the CGI animation, I think Captain Carrot would be a huge hit.
Yeah.
Do any of you know who Captain Carrot is? It's basically a Bigfoot superhero thing. It was a parody of all of the superhero things that were around at the time. And it basically was a group of animals who got superpowers, and they lived in an anthropomorphic world. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So like Howard the Duck, but just with like a bunch of billion different animals.
Right, exactly. And it was an animal world. The humans didn't exist. In fact, in the first issue, I believe Superman crossed over into
an
alternate universe, and that's
how it first step with first issue.
There he is, you know?
We've got a couple more minutes here. Does anybody have any more questions about something? We've got one right over here.
Yeah, are there any current or recent animation that you're not involved with, but that you're a fan of?
Yeah, I love all the movies. I mean, the movies are just really delightful and enjoyable. I think the most stunning surprise was How to Train Your Dragon. That was such a touching film. I mean, the ending on that film was totally, you didn't see that coming. And nobody had ever done anything like it. But almost all the good animated films are just thoroughly enjoyable. And I certainly watch some of the cartoon shows when they come on. I can't come up with anything at the moment, but I do tune in, and I do watch, and there's a lot of good stuff out there, but who's got the time? My gosh, I have to take the time to sit down and watch Daredevil and Stranger Things and stuff. In fact, I just finished Stranger Things, and I got to say, that's my new thing right there. Stranger Things is just awesome.
Yeah, you're kind of immersed into the world of Star Wars right now, but is there some animation that you're working on or that you could be working on coming up? Or
Transformers Robots in Disguise is what I'm on right now, and I'm hoping to do more with Hasbro. This is actually my first run with them. And we don't know exactly what's going on at Marvel. They're kind of in transition. They're still doing Guardians of the Galaxy, but Disney has kind of given them their own reign. They won't be under the Disney tent anymore animation-wise. So we'll probably see less of the silly cartoons like, Ultimate Spider-Man and Hulk and the Agents of Smash, although I have a really fun time working on that show. Those are geared toward little kids. They're trying to dumb down the stuff a little bit. And I think the last great one that was done was Avengers vs. Mighty Heroes.
Yeah, that was the more serious
one. I wish they'd have done more of those.
So is that almost like Marvel Studios is its kind of own thing?
It's an outside studio, but they were under the watchful eye of Disney. Still are.
All right. Well, how can fans find out more about you? We mentioned the website.
Yeah, and I'm certainly on Facebook and stuff. I don't promote myself overly much, but certainly I put up artwork when I finish something, like when I get home and if I've got pictures of stuff I've drawn at a convention like this, I'll put those up or whatever I'm working on at home. But so much of my stuff is licensed material that I can't really show. It's not like a comic book artist can get away with showing covers and stuff that they're doing because the comic companies don't care. Well, let me tell you, Hasbro and Lucasfilm, they care. Yeah, you don't want to be the guy who gets thrown in prison for that because literally something leaked at Lucasfilm a year ago when we were working on Rogue One, and my boss there was one of the suspects because there was only a few people who could have leaked these things. Luckily, it turned out to be somebody, but he had to call me and said, "You didn't accidentally." I went, "Absolutely not," So I said, "You're willing to inspect me, come look at my computer and stuff, but it wasn't me." And this guy is doing prison for that.
Oh.
They're not kidding around with this stuff. Yeah, Lucas and Disney are not kidding around.
Joke around it, but you got the gig. You're not going to put any more in jokes in, or at least you're not going to tell anybody about it.
The in joke thing is for young guys. I honestly don't have time for those kind of things.
It's a sweet gig. We love wearing your T-shirts. We love seeing these things, and it's amazing. You've done some amazing work. We're about out of time today, but thank you so much for joining us today, man.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure doing it.
Okay, kids, Terrificon Week on Comic Book Central is well underway. So glad you're on board. Big thanks to Rick Hoberg for joining me at the show and for signing my treasury-sized Star Wars comics. That was great. They're all banged up for me dragging them to school almost every day when I was a kid. But, man, I wouldn't have it any other way. Who needs pristine editions of those? I like my old banged up versions. He was nice enough to sign them. And nice to finally meet the man who put those images into my brain for all time. That was fun. You want some more Rick Hoberg imagery? Check out the website. It's all there. RickHoberg.com. Lots of cool stuff over there. Also, if you want to catch the video of my Q&A with Rick, media outlet Dork Times, they captured the Q&A. They posted it on YouTube. They, along with Angry Geeks, The Dorkening, they've been posting some videos of the Q&As. So be sure to check those out. You get to see the panels at TrevorCon, so that was pretty cool as well. So thanks to those media outlets. Before I close things out for today, though, I want to mention that we are getting closer and closer to episode 150 of Comic Book Central. That is my third anniversary special. That's going to be online Saturday, November 5th. So make sure you're back for that as well. Well, you subscribe on iTunes, man. You're going to get it. But we're going to revisit some of the memorable moments from the past year of the show. And as always, I have a very cool giveaway that I'm going to be announcing in the episodes ahead. So how do you get in the running for that giveaway? Simple. Just send me an email. Tell me about your favorite moment during the past year on Comic Book Central. I'm going to play those favorite moments. We'll revisit those. I'm going to select one email from the ones that come in. That person's going to get the giveaway. Anything from episodes 101, that was my interview with Back to the Future rocker Huey Lewis, all the way through episode 149. So maybe your favorite moment is yet to come in the weeks ahead, but make sure you send me an email, Tell me what you love this year. joe@comicbookcentral.net, or just click that Signal Me tab on the website. I want to hear from you. All right, more Terrificon coolness coming your way tomorrow. Let's keep things animated. What do you say we celebrate 25 years of Ren and Stimpy with co-creator Bob Camp? That sounds like a plan. I'm going to bring you my Q&A with Bob Camp tomorrow. Until then, go watch some cool cartoons. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the Lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 imported license. All the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
Up from the depths, 30 stories high.